Be good.
Welcome back to the show, friends. It's the Monkey Tooth Podcast, and it is I, your friend and host, Andrew. I'm back from the Bombay Beach Biennale in my lovely home with my wonderful and patient and just incredible wife, Tiffany. I'm glad to be back home, but there is part of me that really misses the experience I just had in Bombay Beach. I got 10 interviews done. Done sounds weird. I had the privilege of talking to 10 very different, very unique people. And I've got them all on tape here. And I'll be releasing them over the next 9 weeks. I released an episode last week with Tal Ruspoli, a friend, one of the founders of the Biennale. Yeah, I'm so grateful to have this to share with you. So today's guest is my friend, Sean Guerrero. And Sean was on the program many years ago. He's back. We got deep. We talked about all kinds of stuff. The both of us have had strokes. That was a weird thing to bond over. Yeah, we kind of both had them around the same time. And his was much more serious than mine was. But we did both kind of react to it in similar ways, which was interesting to see. We talked about his art, which is amazing. And I got to spend a little bit more time with Sean this time, which was a real gift for me. I really like him. I got to know his partner, Allison, who is a super cool lady and a fabulous writer and a tile sculptor artist. She's an artist in her own right. So yeah, it was fabulous. Sean has has bought property down there with his friends, the Colorado compound in Bombay Beach. And I got to see all those guys and reconnect with another guy who will be on the program, a guy named Jay. That's coming up soon. So yeah, I've got a lot for you here, and I feel so grateful. I spent 7 days down there in the Salton Sea. I got to host a radio show, like actual radio, not fake radio, like podcasting. That was a real gift. Man, wonderful. But one of my favorite things is to sit down with people and ask them questions and just listen to them tell me stories. And I got to do that a lot. So look forward to more of those, starting with last week's with Tao, this week's with Sean, many more to come. Yeah. I want to tell you, though, if you're interested in all this art, all this happening in Bombay Beach, and you've never been, I highly suggest going. You don't have to be there for the Biennale. There's plenty to see there when that's not happening. You know, in the summer, it is absolutely brutal. It's in the 120s, and people still live there. And it's an economically depressed area that could use some help. So if you visit BombayBeachBiennale.org, there's resources there where you can help out the Biennale. And there you can see what's happening with the tribal lands nearby. There's some context about the town. Yeah, it's a real community. And it could use some attention that isn't just people going to the Biennale to stare at art. You can buy a hamburger or a beer at the ski inn. That helps. There's all kinds of things you can do if you visit. There's plenty of things you can do if you don't visit. But yeah, you can become a patron of the Biennale in a really sweet way, even just with some spare dollars. The other thing that I would encourage you to go do is look at Sean's website. It's chromesean.com. Sean is, he's a gem. He's a national treasure, I would say. Great storyteller, fun person, creative spirit. I would go so far as to say I love Sean. I think he is a special human being, and his art, if you can, if you've got time to look at it, I highly suggest it. If you've got money to buy it, good on you. Go get it, because it's amazing. If I had a bunch of money, damn right I'd have a sculpture in my yard. But he also makes these cool little robots. He's got this traveling airplane. If you look at the photo in the show notes, Sean outfitted this plane on a chassis that can roll around, you know, that you can tow behind a car or truck. And I think it's like the robot orphanage is what he calls it. He makes all these little robots and goes and sells them around. It's just awesome. Everything he does to me is like so creative and thoughtful and strange and fun and gonzo. He's a little bit gonzo. So I'll stop talking about him and let you just listen to my friend Sean. We started, I'm trying this new thing where I just hit record and don't tell that we're recording until, you know, they may ask or they may never ask and we just go for it. And Sean was talking about a guy named Ken Lane who does a radio show and a podcast called The Desert Oracle, where he noticed that Sean Ken Lane was bemoaning the encroachment of normal people, I guess, into the desert, the light is getting fucked up by so many cities nearby and turning into sort of the angry man in the desert. And it was great because Sean, you know, had his own notes on the situation. So it was a little meta commentary on another man's dealing with the changes in the desert by dealing with the changes in the desert himself. It was great. Good conversation. Love, Sean. Hope you like it too. Until next time, do fun and interesting things, and we'll see you later.
When we talked last, he was blending into a combo of the Art Bell, Ed Abbey, and Zane Grey mindset. Now what I'm seeing is he's just sort of the old book, The Brave Cowboy, that Kirk Douglas had acquired the rights to, was written by Ed Abbey, and it was just about a cowboy not being able to proceed into the new modern times, and he tries to cross a horse at the end, and it gets hit by a truck in a rainstorm.
God.
But he lives, but his trusted horse that is the only thing he can relate to dies. Whiskey was the name of the horse. So point being I believe Ken Lane has now reached the point where he is Ed Abbey in full, angry man of the desert, angry man of the encroachment. That has reached a point where it's beyond fixing.
Do you know him well? Or do you know
him? But I listen to his podcasts all the time, and it's not hard to figure out where he's at, because I think he's going to eventually move out of the desert or go way up high in the Mojave.
Oh, wow.
Or move up to the Pacific Northwest.
Too much encroachment from people.
Yeah.
From others.
Yeah. Desert. Seeing development in, Joshua Tree, as you know, was it not so long ago.
Very quiet place.
Could have qualified, yeah, as a quiet place in a dark sky conservatory.
It's lost area. Dark sky status?
I think there's only nine.
Yeah, very few.
Nine dark skies. Paonia is one of them, officially. Craig Childs does these excursions and talks in various areas, whether it's Moab or... I forget how far south he does it, but I think there's one place in New Mexico. But Joshua Tree now, even when you're up in Wonder Valley in Lucerne, you can still see illumination.
Really?
Yeah.
Yep. Coming from 29 Palms or from...
Yeah, and even Vegas now.
Fuck. Wow.
And an interesting thing that I find also is Bono.
Oh, that crazy dome thing?
And the dome, and then the home... of Bono, of which he is still building up in, I believe it's Brentwood.
And it's just...
It's crazy. So I don't really know him. I don't know what his intentions are. But from where he was to when he was doing the Joshua Tree tour, of which was documented by the photographer Anton Corbin, the nature, we're in the desert. It's alive. It's inspiring. The Joshua Tree...
Where the streets have no name.
Where the streets have no name. Let me come into Brentwood and bulldoze half this mountain so I can build a ramp to get to my mega home on the top of it. Let me build this spherical 3D experience that's going to be the whole new thing. If this one works, because they've been working on it for, what, 15 years? Jeff Frost can fill you in more, one of the artists out here. He can fill you in more on that.
It's got that Citizen Kane vibe.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, when you spend that all that time building the house, it's like the chances that you might die before you ever get to live in it, just go, the longer it takes, the more... There's that intersection where, like, you die the day you move in or something.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know that if I were wealthy enough, I'd want to do that. You know, like, just have some albatross of a project waiting.
Yeah, so it going back to Sandell, before he left, he mentioned this. He said, I went and I tried to find Johnny Ringo's grave. And you can go out to Douglas, Arizona. And the people that owned the land found his skeleton when he is leaning against the tree with a six gun and one bullet shot, of which he offed himself as an old cowboy. And they had found his skeleton remains there, and they just buried him right next to that tree and put a fence around it. So Johnny Ringo was this character that a lot of the other Westerns were developed around, that whole idea. And in the end, he never had fame.
Right.
He was just happy to just die next to a tree. But on the other hand, he loved the desert. He loved that lore. He wore that life. And then you got Bono. And I watched this interview that they were doing 2 months ago because they were out in L.A. and they were the first ones to open up and do their first visual concert experience with that sphere. So while their crew's prepping for all that, and they did their sound checks and everything, they're out in the desert. And it's, I believe it was The Edge and Bono are next to an old Airstream travel trailer being interviewed in old-time metal chairs. Mm-hmm. And they're talking about how beautiful and quiet the desert is and how he's still inspired and how the visuals of the stage show were going to be Joshua Tree in 360, right? Yet, this massive thing that takes a massive amount of electricity, and to go experience and see in 360 Joshua Tree, just right up the road, from Joshua Tree in Vegas, right?
Yeah.
So, is there something missing here when you can just go and actually just do it?
It's looking for darkness with a flashlight.
Yeah.
Like, what the fuck are you doing? I get it. You show a pretty picture, you show a thing, you're trying to make it. That's a lot of art. It's the simulacrum, the you're making a fake thing to represent a real thing, but that's a lot of juice to show you something that you could just go see.
Well, on the technological end of these purveyors of sound technology, you know, like when Dolby Laboratories had sound separation on four channels and quad and all that, I do understand why they're trying to be way up there with that technology, because what he was explaining for the system is you will be able to see, depending on where you're at in that that auditorium, the finest, most minute nuances with the musicality of whether it's a background vocal by some singer or a high note that The Edge is hitting on his guitar in a different part. It's state of the art sound. So maybe that's part of the experience.
I appreciate that. I mean, that's one of those things that, like, I don't know. That's hard to beat great sound. You know, that's like a...
Oh, yeah. Just like Laserium. Remember when Laserium was coming around to a lot of the planetariums in the late 70s? Laserium, the experience, you know, and then they got the rights to like Pink Floyd and all that. And you're Led Zeppelin, like, whoa, I'm looking at all the psychedelic colors.
Yeah. Big black woman ain't got no soul. And like some little chick just walks across.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. No, I totally dig that. But I was talking to, do you know Cody?
The roadie? Yeah. He's an interesting guy. Really good guy. Yeah,
great Cody. Guy, man. We were talking about music and like, you know, just his whole thing, like working with these artists to try to make sure that their equipment works right. You know, mm-hmm. they put all this effort in this rehearsal and this time, and they've got this little window mm-hmm. to shine, right? And, you know, I've been to concerts where it's like, it's in a field and it's just like, you know, a couple big speakers and some bass, and it's just mic'd just right on some acoustic instruments.
Yeah.
And the sound is so perfect for the environment, you know, like, and like the music was made for that environment. You know how like a stadium rock was made with the stadium in mind, you know? And if you find a place that has absolutely almost like earbud perfect sound, but it is the size of U2's, you know, Splendid Dome or whatever you want to call it. That's a weird trick. You know, if you've got this perfect representation of sound in a huge venue.
If I was ever to have a one-on-one with Bono, I would say, because I remember when I lived in Summit County, Colorado, and I remember there was a big storm, when snowstorm, when they were doing their one of the first ones, their first album, and they got stuck in this snowstorm. And so my buddy Matt was from Chicago. He lived in a funky old cabin, and he used to go down to this little bar called the Snake River Inn. It was just this drunk mass little mountain town bar, and he was going to play his bass. No one was there because it was snowing like hell. Well, then this guy and these two guys come in and sat down, and they didn't have nothing to do. And so it turned out to be Bono and the Edge. And so they all jammed on this little stage. But then I remember they also premiered at Red Rocks in outside of Denver. And what made Red Rocks so perfect for sound was it was a natural amphitheater.
Yeah, exactly.
And I would say to him, so when you were starting young in your early career on that tour, did that amphitheater inspire something in you from the clarity of the sound that it projected to lead to where you are now for this thing, because the technology is there at this time?
You know what's funny? Because when you're on stage performing, you've got monitor mix, mm-hmm. right? And so for you, you can really dial in the experience of yourself playing, right? Mm-hmm. You kind of have to be able to perform it well with, you know, your partners.
Yeah.
And so I don't know. I feel like I've heard that Red Rocks is great for bands, mm-hmm. for the band. Like the monitor mix there works well with the shape of the building. But yeah, well, I'd be curious to know if that did have any kind of, if that made its way back to him, you know, if you can.
It kind of goes back to the primordial thing of chanting and right. sound amplification right. and becoming kind of one with the audible.
David Byrne does like a TED talk about this. And it's all about like the music being made starting from chanting and, you know, rhythmic drumming.
Yeah.
Given the instruments that you had available and the environment you were in. You know, they just suited, and we've always made music for the environment. But now what's interesting is live performance is headphone monitor.
Mm-hmm.
So you don't need necessarily on stage monitors. You have in ear. And so that's a perfect one-to-one. You have exactly what you want. You can just dial it in, you know, iPod style.
Mm-hmm.
And then the crowd, that technology is getting amazing. I mean, the way that these speakers can represent sound.
Yeah.
I think it's going to sort of change that music to environment sort of thing.
So where we are right here in Bombay Beach, there's a point to this aspect of what we're talking about, this subject.
We're getting there.
And so the other day, because you hear a lot of things out here, or people who have had some interesting experiences, and one of them I just learned is the train, which is so present here and is just so this.
Yeah.
Right? Well, the new experience for some is to lay in the culverts that go underneath the train tracks. Whoa. And so it has that silt that comes down from the water. And when it rains, then it dries out. So it's cool. It's cool in there.
Yeah.
In these, the culverts underneath the railroad tracks. And then they, some of them, imbibe with various substances.
And wait for the train?
And they wait for the train and they lay inside and then they let the train go over that massive train with all of those engines and that weight and that speed. And they said to me, Sean, you ought to try it. I said, well, I'll just do it. I don't need any of that.
Yeah.
But I do like that kind of thing.
Yeah, we don't need to take, we can just go do that now. We can hit pause.
Yeah. So instead of like going up to the springs and sitting in the water that bubbles and is kind of calming, I think I'm going to give that. Yeah. Maybe that's the new sound bath.
Yeah. Just get, I've been train rattled. Like, boy, your skin looks great, Sean. What have you been doing? I'm recently train rattled.
Yeah, I've been doing some train rattling skin bath. Massage spa.
I've been in a silt bath train massage.
sound train massage for my skin.
With a silt scrub.
Yeah.
Oh my God, that's awesome.
Boy, we got cosmic on those last little things.
We're around. We're in the right place for it, man. So just we're in Bombay Beach in the middle of this massive production of creatives and weirdos and curious people. And you're back for what, the seventh, eighth year? How many years have you been doing this?
I think about at least seven, Andrew, at least seven, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And this year, did you do any big sculptures this year?
Yes, I did. The one that I did was here in November, December. I call it Tengam.
Tengam. Like T-I-N?
T-E-N.
T-E-N.
G-A-M. And it's basically, the way I derived that name is, it's magnet spelled backwards.
Okay. Yeah.
And I didn't know this when I was creating the name, but I needed, the name just, it spawned itself. So from that name, it spawned the idea from some things, some pieces that I had been, that were sitting in my shop in Colorado. For quite a while, I was cleaning out a lot of stuff, and I was going to scrap all these things, but I said, no, it's not every day you can come upon these objects, stainless steel, some polished aluminum, other things that I don't work with all the time in my medium, and it just kept percolating, Tengam, magnet. And then that started taking me into, suppose, because I like time machines, right? Suppose this thing's sort of along the lines of the Doctor Who phone booth that can go anywhere. And it's this booth, so to speak, powered by this engine on top. And the technology that drives it is magnetic, maglev, so to speak. So it can vertically or horizontally move without any physical electrical current.
Right.
And that's what spawned it. And then I needed a place to find to where it would sit properly.
Yeah.
So I built it and I prefabricated in my shop. And then I came out here and I walked around. And that certain part of the beach where I have a lot of my other sculptures, I said, well, this looks cool. Then I did some research and realized, okay, well, where I want to put it is this place that formerly existed called the Luck of the Irish Bar. Right? When you go out there, you know, you can still see some of the remains of the foundations, some of the concrete, some of the wood. And interestingly enough, I had to have the platform for the booth itself, the Tengam booth that you sit in. It had to be elevated, because I wanted it to be viewed so that when the sun was going down with the materials I was utilizing, those would be visualized for photographic purposes, everything, the shadow, the light, and the materials I were using were so out of place from what was used to be there out of wood.
Yeah.
And next door here, Louis's old place, it got purchased, and there were a lot of old railroad ties. And what do most of the people out here do? Well, they put those railroad ties to use. So those became the vertical posts for basic foundation to sit up high enough so that when you're in the booth, you have to walk up to the platform and you just sit there kind of and contemplate in a space. You're looking out at another space, this place, and when it's quiet and all the wind's coming or going, or you got the full moon out and the beautiful stars and all that, you look at what once was.
Yeah.
The past is the future now.
Past is the future now.
Now, yeah. Where you are at.
Mm.
And then getting creative, once again, I'm been doing a lot of things with smashed up road signage. I'm getting into this abstract kind of thing. It's been going on off and on for 5 years. But I like taking the juxtaposition of rule making, which I don't like, and repurposing it as a metaphor. So, case in point, I did one sign and it said, be prepared to stop. This stop sign, warning you, okay, get ready, there's a stop sign or a stoplight coming ahead, pay attention. Well, it was all smashed up. And so I took some of my chrome pieces from the old bumpers, which are from cars of which you drive, and if you don't pay attention, you're going to smash the car up because you didn't pay attention to the damn sign.
Right.
So I utilized that in a different way and took it out of context. So don't look at it as just a smash road sign. Use it as a metaphor in life, like be prepared to stop. What's the artist trying to say? Hey, maybe be prepared to stop being an idiot, or be prepared to stop analyzing. Be prepared to stop and smell the roses. Be prepared to stop and talk to somebody. It goes in so many avenues of verbal basic conversation.
It makes me think of that specific phrase, makes me think of something that you and I both share,
mm-hmm.
is that we've both had a stroke.
Yes.
And be prepared to stop. You and I have both stopped for a second. And I was not prepared for it. And it also makes me think of being like stop is like the final. You know, we stop and go, but there eventually will be a stop and no go.
Mm-hmm.
Be prepared for that.
Yeah.
Eventually you're going to turn this machine in, and I hope to have used mine to the fullest. If it's a smashed up bumper when I put it in the shop, fine.
Yeah.
But yeah, be prepared to stop. I like that. Are you comfortable talking about your stroke at all?
Yeah, sure.
I want to get there, but I do want to stay on this thread of your art for a bit. But
okay. I'll just go into the last part of it. So what I realized was I wanted it to be more than just a booth that I had to verbally explain or put in text of what it is.
Yeah.
So I took a couple more pieces of road signage and I changed them around and I placed them on the back of the 10 gam. So when you're in the booth, it faces west. And when you look at the top of it above where you're sitting in that chair, it says detour. And then the second word down from the sign, from another sign. And then at the bottom, I found something that said space. Reason being this, my pet peeve against some of these very well-known artists that have strata money and strata ateliers have the grandiosity in their ego to say, I'm going to create, and you'll know who it is going to be when I reveal this, spherical objects out of special material based upon 31 of moon phases that you can purchase each one for like $2.6 million. But you don't get the physical object. You get an NFT of this object that you bought, which was just recently placed in a cube and supposedly shot on a Falcon-esque rocket, rocket, and now sits on the surface of the moon.
Right.
And I remember recently when that happened, the Navajo Nation petitioned Congress to not let this happen. It's the commercialization of the moon. And they were saying, look, this is something that's sacred.
Yeah.
Stop violating these things. Stop going beyond your little human globe, because that's already saturated with ego and waste and other things. There's areas we need for purity, contemplation, and to exist in with a peaceful environment for our health.
Yeah.
So you've now got these artists that are thinking on this strata of like, they're trying to market it in a different way.
Sure.
But to me, I'm saying with that statement, hey, detour from space, you guys or gals.
Leave it alone.
Yeah. Leave it alone, man. What is enough? You know, a car floating in space with some damn mannequin that because you can, just let it go off in space. Now we're seeing art imitate life, which was that Ralph Bashke. It was an early 70s animation film where, I forget the song, it was by ZZ Top, and one of the visuals in this animation is this car floating off in space. And that was in the late 70s.
Yeah.
So now you see it's real.
Yeah, we've done it.
Yeah.
We have the technology.
And now you got a guy who's saying, oh, look, I'm going to take these objects, spherical objects made out of a rare metal, and I'm going to stick them. They represent the moon, and I'm going to put them on the moon.
It's like having a sphere show you the desert when you're in the desert.
Mm-hmm.
It's a hat on a hat.
It's such absurdity.
Yeah. Looking hat on a hat.
Yeah. So my intention with the Tengam that sits here now is I don't know how long it'll last. We get heavy winds here, and it's still held up to the winds. But its purpose is to just, if you go there, you sit, you contemplate, you look at it, and it's its own entity. It's just another one of these
and when you
spaces.
Travel through time, you have to detour through space?
Yeah, I would suppose, sure.
I don't know how it would. I mean, we're currently traveling in time, but just at the rate of our own lives. You know, we're always traveling in time. But if you're going to travel through time or around time,
right?
Maybe you do have to detour from space. You have to like transcend space and go around.
Get a consortium together. Some guy who knows how to bore holes with big objects, big industrial objects. Hey, let's just dig a hole through the middle of the earth and go to a place called China.
Let's just go around. Go
just
through.
Because we can. Let's. Yeah. Yeah. So that's what the Tengam is. And I think it's. God, it's like my fourth or fifth sort of time machine type art piece that I've made.
Let me ask you, if you could travel through time, which way would you go?
Well, there's always the notion of if I could change the mistakes that I made, would I go back to change them? Or would I go into the future to avoid who I was at the time? So, I could be someone that I wasn't, that I wanted to be, that I didn't like when I was younger.
Yeah. I think forward would be, I mean, there's a lot of stuff I'd want to see.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's a lot of like, historical figures, and I'd love to see the California coast before they chopped down all the redwoods.
Yeah.
You know, I'd love to just see,
mm-hmm.
you know, prehistoric Earth. You know, as far as my own life is concerned, I mean, you know, if you go changing it, you might never find the time machine in the first place, you know?
Yeah.
Forward's a good idea. I think forward's a great way to go, because you can, as you are now, you can avoid steps that would produce whatever asshole is waiting for you in the future.
That's true.
I think you might have the right idea. Go forward in time.
Yeah, go forward.
As long as you can get back.
Yeah, as long as you get back, Jojo.
Get back and buy some Bitcoin at the right time.
Jojo was a Bitcoin farmer in the ground. They thought he had some Bitcoin crash.
Man, I've been thinking about you. So I saw you the other day, and you told me you'd also had a stroke, man. And it sounds like yours was maybe a little bit more serious than mine. Was yours a TIA or was yours?
What is the other one? The ischemic or
ischemic?
Ischemic. Yeah. I had the ischemic where you have a wall tear.
Yeah. Oh, wow.
On the vein. Your vein. Mm-hmm.
I had the transient ischemic attack where it was just a blockage for a bit. It popped out of my heart and went up.
Oh, okay.
And it turned out I had a hole in my heart that had to become sealed at a children's hospital in order to prevent that from happening again. I'm still could have another stroke, but hopefully not from that. Knock wood.
Yes.
But yours was a tear in one of your veins?
Yeah, while I was camping up at Brush Creek in Colorado.
Do you mind telling me the story? What happened to you?
Well, it was a place that I've been camping for years when I was living in Crested Butte in the 90s. And then I had always been going back there, whether it was living in Montana or down in Denver or over in France. I always returned to Brush Creek because it was just such an elegant place up in the mountains there. You can go over Pearl Pass. You can go into Aspen or Snowmass and all that. Popular hike, but popular camp space too before COVID kind of changed things. So I was camping up there with a bunch of friends who were gearheads. They were into their motorcycles and all that. And I came back from town. That's about 10 miles away, Crested Butte downtown. And I got up to the campsite and I just started laying down in my van, my Sprinter van. I just kind of felt tired. Mm. And then they all came back around 1 o'clock in the afternoon and they were talking about, you know, what they did, their motorcycles or a mountain bike ride they just were on. And I'm sitting there listening to their stories. You're surrounded by a bunch of aspen trees and all the aspen trees just started looking weird, kind of like you're on mushrooms or something. Yeah. And the leaves were really intense. And then what they were saying was sort of semi-discernible, but not really. And they observed me. And they said, Sean, what, you kind of look like you have some heat stroke. And my buddy filled up a water bottle full of electrolytes and I drank it and it kind of made me feel good again. I went into town to run some errands and they were where I needed to have some cognitive skills in town to deal with. Then I went back up to the campsite. And they were all out running around, and then they were going to cook a big dinner around 10 o'clock at night when it's dark up there. And they finished, and I'm still laid in my van. They said, hey, man, come out and have some food. I said, no, I just want to lay down. Around 2 in the morning, I just felt this intense pain in my forehead on the left side. And I got up. I thought I was having a vertigo attack. I got up and I couldn't even stand up.
Oh, Jesus.
And I said, man, I must have vertigo. So I crawled out of my van and then I tried to stand up again. And it was like, whoa, man, something's going on. So I crawl over to my friend's van door and I bang on it. And I said, hey, Jay, something ain't right. You got to take me down to the paramedic station, the fire station in the middle of town. So it's about, you know, 2:30 in the morning, we drive down there and they hook me up to the EKG and the ambulance. And they said, you're having a stroke. You got to go down to the Gunnison Hospital, which is about a half hour away from Crested Butte. So sure enough, they hook me up and go down to the hospital. I get admitted and they're hooking me up with all this stuff. And they said, this is what's going on with you. Because they do all these tests, as you know, to see whether you got kidney stones or epilepsy, all that. And the doctor came up to me and he says, you have to sign this paper. And I said, what's the paper for? And I can't even swallow now. And I'm starting to get the palsy on my right side.
Right, right.
And meanwhile, my friends are texting me, you know, and I can't answer them or anything. Yeah. So my buddy Jay, he had drove me down there and he's wondering what's happening. And the doctor says, you need to sign these papers because we're going to have an air ambulance come and fly you over into Grand Junction where right they have now a new facility for stroke victims on the fifth floor. And I said, look, I can't do that. I don't have insurance. If I sign this, when I get that bill, it's going to ruin me financially.
Yeah.
And he says, you have no choice. We can't put you in a regular ambulance and drive you 4.5 hours from here the long way because if you don't,
you'll be ruined physically.
You're done.
Yeah.
I said, okay. So I signed it, and the next thing I know, they got me hooked up and secured. And now I'm just, so I tell my friend, here's what's happening. The chopper's going to come and land on the pad, and they're loading me up right now in the gurney. And I was, you know, I'm like, you know, gurgling. And then you're starting to feel this kind of thing here. Was starting to do that. And then your eyes starting to droop. And I can hear the med flight crew saying, okay, let's keep them this way. And then they put me next to the pilot in the chopper, and as the sun's rising.
Oh, my God.
A beautiful sun in a beautiful mountain valley. And my buddy's filming me from the helipad, outside of the helipad, clear zone, with his camera.
Oh, Jesus Christ.
You know, and so I see this good looking, it's this chopper pilot, and he's pretty cool and confident. And then the med crew's sitting in back, and I'm in the gurdy catacorner to the pilot seat. And we just take off, and see it, and the sun's rising. We flew right over Brush Creek, because that's the route where you go to a lot of the aircraft go anyway. We fly over Brush Creek, and I'm looking right down as we're flying over where this happened that night. Mm-hmm. I'm going, wow, man, there's my friends. They're probably saying, there goes Sean. And then we fly over Kebler, which takes you over into Paonia,
yeah,
into the North Fork Valley. And we fly over Grand Mesa and then land on the fifth floor with the chopper. But I'm telling the chopper pilot, man, you're a really good pilot. You know how to fly this thing really good. And so two things happened that I realized as soon as I was flying over Brush Creek. Years ago, when I, you know, sometimes when I sell my sculptures, I meet some interesting people. And I said, hey, you guys, I'm telling my buddies, if I ever get a good sale, I'm going to rent this chopper that comes out of Aspen and it lands down at this little tiny airport there outside of CB. I'm going to rent it and let's fly over Brush Creek so we can see what it looks like from these two red-tailed hawks' point of view. There's always these red-tailed hawks flying over. So in the afternoon, you know, you did a hike or a biking thing and you're laying in your chair or hammock having a beer in this beautiful mountain setting with aspens and all that. These hawks would always fly over and say, I wonder what they see. So at that moment, when I'm in the chopper, I thought, you got your wish, dude. You didn't rent the helicopter, but you are now in a helicopter and you're looking over, seeing what the hawks see.
Yeah.
And I became really calm.
Wow.
I just said, well, if I go, I don't care.
Get my wish, at least
one of them. I could care less. Yeah, I said, now, here's another interesting thing, Andrew. So there was a song that's reverberating in my mind while I'm having this thought. Yeah. And it was that Neil Young song, Long May You Run.
Yeah.
And I think I told you about that in the first podcast we did. And so I got that thought in my mind. Okay, you got to see the hawks and long may you run, although these changes have come. And I said, man, what a way to go. I'm ready. And I had no problem with it.
Wow.
But then, you know, I eventually ended up on the fifth floor and they do these things. You're there for a week and then you start improving because they put you on blood thinners and they do all these MRIs.
Yeah.
And so they say, well, here's what's going on. And this is what it looks like.
Right.
And you had a tear in it on your anterior wall it hasn't healed. So we got to put you on warfarin, that crazy derived from rat poison at the time, you know, as a blood thinner. So you're on it and everything's stable and you're realizing, okay, you're going to have to take this type of medication and this, and if you got to remain within this 2-3 level on your INR level, they call it. And so after a week, they give you the cognitive tests that you have to do. And they say, okay, you're okay to drive. You know how to write checks. You can operate machinery. Your peripheral vision's correct. Everything seems to be okay. But afterwards, this gal I see in Robin, who helped me so immensely, we're in Paonia, you know. She first takes me to the store and says, look, you got to start eating good. And here's what you got to start looking at on the labels. And then now we're back home in Peonia where I was living. And she, you know, we talked. And then I went for a walk around the town that I had been in. And it seemed like someone just took me and dropped me off in some Andy Mayberry unknown town I've never been to. It seemed very, very foreign to me. Very foreign. And now I'm at my shop and I go back in my studio where I'm building sculptures and I'm seeing half-finished sculptures and I'm thinking, I don't know how to fix those. How did I do that? How did I put these things together? It was really weird.
Yeah. Are you on the other side of that now? Have you been able
to?
But you've spent, what, a year, 6 months of occasional confusion?
Well, what happened, I don't know how you handled it for your thing, but for me, I became very hyper aware of little things. Hyper aware.
I'm still a little.
And so, yeah,
I'm still a little like, I'll double check. If I can't remember a name or if I get a little confused, it makes my palms sweat.
It's kind of like a nervous, weird feeling.
Yeah, is it happening?
To me.
Is it happening? You know, like, am I?
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so then if something coincidental happens, you start questioning it. Is that like my hyper awareness or is this just normal?
Yeah.
You know, this is normal experience people have.
I know what you mean, man. I went through, I liken it to a salvia trip I did once that made me kind of scared for like 6 weeks. Like I was questioning things.
Yeah.
But that I had a similar thing where my memory of the hospital and the people in it and all the people I interacted with were extremely acute. Like I was trying especially hard to remember names and what people looked like and jokes and all this stuff. And I wrote it down as soon as I got home. I started writing and I wrote the whole story out and then narrated it and put it to music. So I would always have a memory of that. Cause it was almost like you're trying to regain some agency cause you're afraid of your physicality just turding out on you.
Yeah.
And I wanted to have like, okay, I have to immediately start working on, you know, my observational skills.
Right.
It was like this weird compensatory thing that it popped up in my brain. And it sounds like you kind of did something similar, but yours had more of like a,
I didn't know. So then you start thinking, am I kind of going nutty, going crazy or something? And then people start hearing, he had a stroke. He might. So you become aware of this fact that maybe, now they know that I had a stroke. Sean's acting weird. Well, I've always kind of been goofy.
Right.
Right. But then you don't know, okay, did I just bump the goofy weirdness factor up?
Yeah.
Or are they just thinking that I'm being overly weird to begin with because of that stroke?
You know, it's funny. I think you and I probably put more on ourselves about the stroke. We think about us as being people who have had strokes.
Yeah.
But people don't look at you and be like, oh, that's Sean. He's had a stroke. He's also an artist. It's
right.
Like, you know, that's just Sean.
Right.
He's an artist.
Right.
And six, you know, subjects down the lane. Oh, yeah, that one time he had a stroke. It's not top of mind for most people. But I know exactly what you're thinking about it. It's one of those things where, like, I struggled with admitting that it had happened to me. I was like a little, I would rather say something else shameful that I did on purpose.
Well, I had a different experience from that because this was relatable to a friend who had visited me many times. And we generated a lot of creative ideas up at Brush Creek. And then he had died. And later on during COVID, he was living in Costa Rica and he crashed on a motorcycle. Oh, so shit. When he was cremated, his parents wanted to release his ashes at Brush Creek and they wanted me to be there and I couldn't do it because then you get into survivor's guilt. Because now you survived this thing there.
Right.
And he didn't. And so how do you process that? Like, okay, let's release his ashes while you're here where you almost died. But you lived. He didn't. There's something in that mix.
Yeah.
And I understand kind of the soldier's survivor's guilt mentality now from their point of view.
There was a point in my life where these two best buddies, like we were just thick as thieves, and they're both dead.
Mm-hmm.
And it's weird for me to every once in a while, I'm like, oh man, Sam and Aaron are dead.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you've got that weird last man standing thing. It's like they were way hardier and stronger and smarter guys. How are they gone?
Yeah.
And they were young. I mean, I'm young. I'm 45.
Yeah.
And they've been dead. So I get that feeling of like, well, how?
Well, he introduced me to Bombay Beach in 2001.
No way.
Yeah. So all these things go through.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing on the back end of how I started to relearn how I processed my sculptures again, to go back in there and work power tools and grind and cut and be creative. Yeah. Hunter Thompson enters into the frame.
Shit.
Right?
Yeah, there you go.
So this weird Hunter Thompson stuff, I've read his books. My buddy over here grew up around the dude when he was living in Aspen. So this stuff starts filtering in. Mm-hmm. And the first thing was this guy that's doing a house behind my shop tells me, hey, Sean, man, you want these old papers that of Aspen times? It's when Hunter passed away. They're special editions. I got 10 of them. They're in mint condition. You want them? Okay. So I read it. And I said, well, this is interesting. And then it gets me to this next thing, which is I learned that Bob Broaddus, the sheriff, is still alive. He was 5-time sheriff of Aspen. Really cool guy. He's friends with this younger cat, DJ Watkins, who now is the purveyor of anything Hunter Thompson shotgun art, Ralph Steadman, Tom Benton. And Hunter Thompson was a purveyor for radicalism, radical gonzo approach to the involvement of big developers and all this coming and changing mountain towns. Totally against it. So I learn about this event that they're going to do in front of this place called the Gonzo Gallery, of which DJ owns. It's now called Fat City. And they're going to be doing these series of lectures in front of the Gonzo Gallery called the Liberty Lounge Series, where guest speakers come. They talk about things, environmental, whatever. And I said, well, that's interesting. So I go on one of the videos that they save, and you can watch. And then I saw somewhere the Gonzo fist, the 6-fingered Gonzo fist. And I got this idea. I said, you know what? To see that I can go back to my roots and see if I can weld, I'm going to construct this very large chrome Gonzo fist with the peyote button in the middle and the 6 fingers to see if I can actually, when I first started, I welded with chrome pieces, chrome plated metal of bumpers. That's when I very first got into my artwork. And so I said, okay, I'm going to build it. And I start building it. And these other weird Hunter Thompson things start occurring. So now I'm starting to think, am I reading into this too much or what? I'm going to go with the little voices that's there saying, maybe this is how you can learn. It takes me into this dynamic where I am now obsessed. I'm going to make this Gonzo fist, but what am I going to do if I do make it? And I'm going to have people come in and say, do you know what this is? Does it look right? Does it look like my old art? You know, does it have some sort of value? Well, I started thinking Liberty Lounge, Hunter Thompson, my buddy had just given me this big wooden crate. I take this crate. It shipped some big bronze piece from Thailand or something, and it was a pretty good size crate. I aged it all out, and I made it look like it came from the Tate Gallery in London. And then I thought, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to take this Gonzo fist and stick it in this crate, and then I'm going to create this fake story of where it was sitting at Dennis Hopper's house in Santa Fe. And Dennis Hopper never got to send it to Marlon Brando when Marlon was living in Mulholland Drive. I'm going to write down the address of Dennis Hopper's place at the Maybell Lujan house when he lived there in the 70s. And I'm going to write down Marlon Brando's ship to address. I'm going to age it out. And I'm going to create this idea and put it on some casters and put the thing in there. And I'm going to get my friend and I, and we're going to dress like gypsies and push it around downtown Aspen, right? while people are eating in the middle of summer at all these restaurants and play Roma music on top of it through a Bluetooth speaker. And everyone's going to say, what's in the box?
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So I got my buddy to help me push it around, but we needed one more guy because our ultimate destination is we're going to push it in front of the Liberty Lounge series of speaking outside of the Gonzo Gallery. And so we pushed the damn thing around. My other buddy who is here, he plays, his character is the rich Aspen rancher art buyer type guy.
Yeah.
So, you know, you got to have the third person to get the story going. So the backstory is me and my friend as gypsy guys are sent to Santa Fe, New Mexico, or Taos, New Mexico to pick up this long lost dusty box that's sitting in this other older artist's studio. And he learns of it and he wants to buy it, but he wants us to go pick it up, meet him in Aspen because he's wanting to attend this Liberty Lounge lecture thing, then go into the Fat City Gallery and purchase one of Hunter's shotgun art things.
Yeah.
Right? So he's technically the owner. We're just the lackeys that are sent to do it. And we just want to get paid for delivering this this sculpture.
You're just on the job.
So we end up getting there in front. And after the lecture is done, the owner, who I didn't know at the time, he says, hey, what's in the box? Because there's a bunch of people around. They're going, hey, have you seen this box? It's got Dennis Hopper, Marlon Brando, Tate and London Gallery on it. Like, and we put a chain around it. We had an old lock. I made it look very official.
Oh, my God.
So I said, we can't tell you because we don't know. We were just sent down to Taos to pick it up. We're supposed to meet this guy here. He's going to pay us, and he wants to see your thing, but I don't know where he is. So we're waiting around, and then all of a sudden, Greg had to go get a couple of whiskeys in him to hold character, and he walks right up, and he looks, and he holds character, and he looks just the part. So we said, oh, well, there's the owner right now. Ask him. So the owner and Bob brought us a couple of the lawyers, some of Hunter's old lawyers and some old Hunter crew. They're going, hey, well, why don't you bring the box in the gallery? Why don't you bring it in there into the gallery? So he says to Greg, thinking it's the owner, hey, could we bring this in the gallery? Now I'm going, whoa, man. It's now in an official high-end art gallery. I don't know. You know, I don't go, I do not do protocol. And so so it's now in there and people are saying, well,
it's gonna open it.
What's in there? Open up the box. Greg's playing the part. He's going, you idiots. You didn't lose the key or nothing, did you? No, man, we didn't open it. It's cool. So Greg ends up having the key. He says, well, here, why don't you open it? He gives it to DJ. DJ opens it, right? And in it, because he collects everything Hunter Thompson, you know, official. Yeah. And in it is a chrome-plated gonzo fist with a peyote butt and all that. And he goes, oh, wow, man, this is really cool. So he pulls it out, and we put it on a pedestal, and now right after, only 2 weeks after I had a stroke, I have this art piece.
I'm back, baby.
In this Hunter Thompson official gallery of his shotgun art.
That was the initial showing.
That was the initial showing because he doesn't even allow you to photograph that artwork on the walls, his shotgun art hanging on the walls. So now my piece on a pedestal is sitting next to the Elvis picture that shotgun that Broaddus and Stranahan had shot. It's next to this Elvis piece. And he's looking at it, and then he says, hey, do you want to sell it? I never thought I'd get that far in a million years. So now Greg says, because we didn't expect it, we got to figure something out, because they still think we're just lackeys, and Greg's the owner. So I said, Greg says, hey, you guys, hang on, DJ. I need to talk to these guys. So we go outside. He acts like he's smoking a cigarette. He goes, shit, man, what do you want for it? What do you want for it? I said, I don't know, $10,000. He said, okay. So we go back in there and play it up. And then I sell the damn thing. But the weirdest thing, it gets weirder.
How could it not?
A total 100. So the weirdest thing is, When I was down in Taos, New Mexico, years before, I meet a Frenchman and I buy a glass eyeball. It was a real German glass eyeball. And I just wanted to get a glass eyeball. I didn't want to put it in my eye. I don't need one. I don't have a fake eye. I just wanted to have a glass eyeball.
Fair enough.
And I would wear it around in this little thing on a necklace sometimes when I would attend these events. So I'm wearing this thing in this black little velvet sachet, and I know it's a glass eyeball, but I don't want to lose it. So I stick it in the box while we open the box, hoping that it doesn't catch and I lose it.
Right.
And then I forget that I left it in the box. After all said and done, we go back home. And so he finally does some research, him and his gal and a couple other people, and they realize it's me. Oh, that's this guy that lives in Paonia. So once he does that, I said, hey, did you find a glass eyeball? He goes, what are you talking about? I said, I lost my glass eyeball. He says, well, you didn't look like you had a glass eye, a fake eye. I said, no, I lost my glass eyeball. Can you ask your assistants if they found this glass eye? Because it's special to me. And he doesn't know that I don't need it. So one of the guys that was there was Bob Broaddus, the sheriff. And another guy that was there, this old Englishman, I had no idea was Elvin Rothschild.
Oh, my God.
Right?
Wow.
Because he used to come to these things and sit. And so as time went by, I was sitting in this couch, and I'm talking about, I have no idea who he really is. He's just this tall man with a nicer looking younger wife. And I started talking about British Spitfire Royal Marine engines during World War II. And this guy's saying, well, do you know the horsepower output at a vertical climb of 13,000 feet could outperform a P-51 or a P-40 Thunderbolt? In an English accent, I'm saying, wait a minute, who is this dude?
Yeah, yeah.
And so I asked DJ after I start getting to know him, who was that guy? He says, that's Elvin Rothschild.
Jesus.
I said, of the Rothschild family? Like, he says, yeah. Yeah, oh, so So then I started thinking, am I hyper aware? And is there something talking to me and leading me in this weird direction? Because I could get into it even deeper with the Dennis Hopper thing, I won't because of time constraints.
Right.
But I just said, man, I am living a Hunter Thompson novel. So the thing that Bob Broaddus dug and DJ dug and all that crew is now we were in their thing, because Bob told me, what you guys did was what we used to do in the early 70s when it was in mountain town, and artists would do these things called happenings.
Yeah.
And you didn't need these high-end bougie art galleries to come in and say, you can come in here.
Right.
You can come in here, but you, local artists, can't.
Right.
And so when they did one of their first happenings, they hired a kid from New York who was a graffiti artist, and one of the guys in Aspen at the time had some old Cadillac, and this kid from New York who'd never been out of the inner city got to come to Aspen and graffiti out this car as an art project without no rules or regulations. So that's my ethos now, I think, with my direction is meeting younger kids, having a focus, believing in yourself, don't believe the hype, don't try to see what you see on social media.
Yeah.
Do it from the little small things that reveal themselves and trust what your inner body tells you. That's what is so far forgotten now in today's modern times. But that's what Hunter wrote from. He wrote from the internal soul of the direction he believed in. And that's kind of, he had some problems, you know, for sure. But it led me into this whole new strata of that. And maybe that's why I lived from this event that happened.
I mean, that you did live, and whether or not that is some cosmic sense of purpose or a sense of purpose that you've been able to write down yourself, it doesn't really matter.
Right.
It's the fact that you believe it is enough.
Yeah.
And that you're doing it, and that serendipity is there.
Yeah.
And you're showing up for it. and making the stuff and the doing gonzo art.
Yeah.
You know, that's just perfect. It's so perfect.
Well, so on the plane, the airplane, you're going to see three, I call them gonzo bombs. It's basically the, when Hunter ran for sheriff, the star.
Yeah.
And then it's the gonzo fist in there. I've got three of them. Each one was what I call an art bomb. Mm-hmm. And the last one was this last event we did in Aspen. But the first one was a little film that I did in the 90s in Crested Butte. I'm going to do another one. So they'll be, you know, when the pilots used to put down their bombing missions underneath the windows of the plane. That's kind of what it is. People might think it's some bomb thing, but it technically is a bomb,
but
it's an art bomb.
Yeah, the explosion's not going to dismember.
It's an art
kill.
Explosion or a creative explosion.
Right, right.
You know, but it's kind of unplanned, and then it goes through, and then you succeed with the mission.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
That's
so that's what those mean.
That's killer. Well, Sean, I know you're a busy guy. You have 1,000 things to do today, and you took any time out to talk to me.
Yeah, I enjoy always talking and catching up with you, though, Andrew. And I really love that you came back out here, and we just got to converse and catch up on our stories and paths.
Yeah.
For sure.
I'm glad you're all right, man.
Yeah, well, and the same for me to you.
Yeah. It's a scary thing, man, to see your vulnerability. What got your old man?
He had COPD.
Okay.
Yeah, he smoked in COPD and then smoking does not go together. But he did quit smoking, but that caught up with him. And my dad wasn't really into a lot of physical activities.
Yeah.
But he was a very, very creative, kind man and very reserved, who had a really interesting life also.
Well, your stroke wasn't a lifestyle problem.
No.
It was just a thing that happened. Yeah. Same. Mm-hmm. I wasn't like, I was in the best shape I've been in my adult life when it happened.
Yep.
So, yeah. But I mean, you
never know.
The thing that a buddy of mine said to me that he would probably have said to you if he knew you as well, he's like, man, you had a stroke. That's crazy. At least I don't have to tell you to go live your life. Because you already do that.
Right.
You already live like you might be dead forever. You know?
Yeah. And I enjoy I really enjoy doing what I'm doing.
Yeah.
I enjoy talking to people, and I enjoy this strange little tribe that exists here, the energy that it creates, the tension, the talks that you have around the campfire. But when things get hairy, you just go walk out in the desert. You can walk under a full moon by yourself and listen to the coyotes and the little burrowing owls and just look up at the stars. The other night, we got to see that damn rocket.
That was amazing.
Yeah.
That was so crazy.
Like, what more do you want?
Perfect timing where it was still catching the setting sun.
Oh, it was unbelievable. Unbelievable. So, and I hope to, you know, with some of the younger guys and gals that come through here and do their creative stuff, I try to inject a positive aspect into their belief and idea that they can make it. You're not going to get rich, but you can live an interesting life through the people that you meet to continue your vision. If you keep it kind of pure, the intentions pure, and think good things, bad things and good things happen. But as you get older, you need to refine your focus. You know, it's almost like at some point you got to have that tunnel vision to where you want to be. And I don't know if that's the power of will or whatever it is, but I just think that if you are a little bit more focused, you can see aspects of that come to fruition.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's about as good a place to leave it as I can think of.
Right on, right on. Write down your dreams. Looking at the back of your computer.
Do you want to sign us off with a little... We did a Desert Oracle last time. Do you want to do that again, or do you want to do your own thing?
Let me think. Let me give you something brief. Let me see if I can remember this poem from the Moody Blues.
Nice.
Breathe deep the gathering gloom. Watch lights fade from every room. Impassioned lovers, restless one. Lonely man cries for love and has none. New mother picks up and suckles her son. Senior citizens wished they were young.
cold-hearted orb that ruled the night, remove the colors from our sight, red, grays, yellows, and white. But we decide which is right, or which is an illusion.